So as I mentioned, tonight's the last of this series of talks on the Four Noble Truths, and I want to talk on the last three steps on the Eightfold Path. Wise effort, right mindfulness, and skillful concentration. And these are often conglomerated together and called the meditative steps, if you want. Because they speak very directly to the practice itself. So I want to start with wise effort. And this is a tricky one, actually. Effort is a tricky thing because we sort of have to figure out, you know, how much energy to put into the practice. How we can do that skillfully. And there's sort of this balance of two things and sort of contradictions that we need to resolve at the beginning of this process of just figuring out how much effort to put into things. And I want to read something from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was one of the teachers of Joseph Goldstein and those other folks who were the original people who went to the East in the 60s as Peace Corps members and studied in this form, this tradition. And he's quite interesting what he has to say here. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away, but the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It's important to make effort where this distress appears. We might feel we should be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We should eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We go here and there as we wish, following our impulses like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scriptures, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, if I'm going to be a supremely awakened Buddha, may this dish flow north. The dish flowed to the north. In other words, against the current. And that's really a lot of what this practice is about, in some sense. We're going against the current of our culture and the current of our society, the current of our habits. And that makes it difficult sometimes. So there's that balance we have to look for. There's also the whole thing where often you read in the teachings that you have Buddha nature, that we all have Buddha nature, that we all have the potential to become Buddhas, which is true. I sincerely believe that we're sort of naturally perfect. If that's true, then the question quickly arises, like, well, why do we have to do anything at all? Why do we have to apply any effort at all if we're already perfect? And to put it as simply as I can, in terms of absolute reality, what's called absolute reality, yes, this is true. We all have Buddha nature. But in terms of relative reality, you know, our day-to-day experience, we don't know this with, you know, the know with a capital K, know. We don't experience that being that perfection on a day-to-day regular basis. In fact, often we've experienced just the opposite. The world seems full of suffering. These days, that's pretty obvious, right? And we feel anything but perfect. And so how do we resolve this? Some teachers tell us we just need to let go, to sink into our true nature. That sounds pretty nice. Just let go and sink into our true nature, right? But paradoxically, letting go actually takes great effort. It takes an enormous amount of energy. Because letting go implies that we drop all of our usual reactive patterns, all of our ways of our habits of mind. Most of the time we're operating what I like to think of as autopilot. Something arises and we fall into this habitual pattern of reaction to what that arising is. And that's just being human. Nothing wrong with that. It's just that's how we operate. And this is what this practice is all about. It's to help us see how little of our time is actually spent in the present moment. How most of the time we're off spinning stories about ourselves, reliving old hurts, missing something or someone that's no longer there, fantasizing about the future. It's like 1,000 different mind movies that we're watching all the time, one after another, sometimes jumping, sometimes mixing them together. But they're all just mind movies starring me. That's where we spend most of our time mentally. We don't spend it in the present moment. And this practice of just being in the present moment, of actually paying attention to what's arising right now and staying in the present moment, starts to undo these mental patterns, starts to break them down. This isn't easy. The word for effort is virya in Pali. And the root of that is vira, which is usually translated as a hero, like a warrior hero. So not only do we need to put energy into the practice, we need to do it courageously, heroically. We're going against everything our culture teaches us that should make us happy. Against all our own embedded views of our culture, of our upbringing, of everything. And to go against that, it takes a lot of courage. And that effort, that courage is important. In some traditions, they talk about people who tend to take the practice being warriors. And that's where that idea comes from. The trick, of course, is that we don't want to put in too much effort. Too much effort doesn't work either. It's like, and we do this because we sort of get caught in this idea that somehow we're supposed to succeed. Or to feel we have some obligation, we sense it's our duty to practice, or we should be practicing hard all the time. We get caught in this mindset, and this that old adage, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, right? It's true. It applies very directly. We have to find this balance. Too much effort what often you'll see in the literature is called striving, over-striving, just makes this practice really grim. It's like, oh God, I have to practice again because it's really good for me. And we sort of moan as we sit down on our cushion. This is not skillful or helpful at all. So we need to relax into our true nature and not force ourselves. But at the same time, we can't relax too much because we have to put effort into this practice. And this is really important. We have to enjoy the practice. We actually have to enjoy what we're doing. If you look at any statue of the Buddha, all the traditional iconography of the Buddha has him with this little sort of subtle, sort of like Mona Lisa smile. Like he's always subtly, not like wildly happy, just he's happy. And we want to do that. So what does this mean? What is traditionally said about right effort? How can we make sure as best we can that we're putting wholesome effort into the practice? And there are four aspects to this. And we need to look at all four of these in our practice and in our lives for that matter. And the first aspect is to do whatever we can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. Seems, all these things seem obvious when we hear them, but it's like, how often, in practice, we're sitting there and we see this familiar pattern of thought arise. And there we are just sitting there innocently watching our breath. And here's this old story that starts running. And it's like we have to see it. Oh, it's that old story again. I know where this is going to go. I know the end point of this chain of thoughts. And then you just decide you're not going to go there. I'm not going to do that. I don't have to follow that storyline. Don't go there. You're actually trying to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. This is right and understanding put into action. There we are back at step one, but it's related directly to step six here, right effort. We understand where this process is going, and we decide, yeah, I'm going to steer this little bit here. And we have to also, when we do that, we can't sort of like be too harsh. We have to sort of just see it for that story, for what is just another arising of impermanent stuff in the mind. Maybe even laugh at ourselves. Oh God, there's that old one again. And let's give ourselves a little chuckle. Like be a little relaxed about this, And in our day-to-day life, this has a somewhat broader meaning because we have to look at everything we do, all the things we habitually do, how we act in the world, what we do to entertain ourselves, what we do to make a living, what we do, all those things. Who do we hang out with? Oh, there's a good one. Who do we hang out with? And say, where does this take me to a place of unwholesome mind states? If I hang out with this person or these people, my old buds from college or whatever, do I end up once again doing something not very wholesome? Oh, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe I should make that choice to not do that. Not easy to do, but it's like, that might be a skillful way to deal with this. So the second aspect of right effort is to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states once they have arisen. So now it's not, now we're in the middle of one of those stories and we're caught in the unwholesome, and we can see, oh my God, this is really not cool, basically. This is not a wholesome way. And this isn't easy, because it's so much easier just to sort of go along with those familiar patterns. So much easier just to sort of coast. And to do that, we sometimes, what we need to do in the practice itself, we won't be sitting and we're caught, we can feel the heat of the anger or the draw of the desire, the lust, whatever. It's really skillful to stop the story, in a sense, and drop down into the body. Really pay attention to what this feels like in the body. This has two advantages. One is it sort of mutes the story. The story's probably still running, but it's on mute now, at least. And also, it puts us into the present moment, because now we're paying attention to what's arising in the body, as opposed to just letting this story whirl around in our head. These stories hook you. They're emotionally compelling. And we go through these stories over and over. Sometimes with slight variations, sometimes it works out better than others. We imagine if I only did this and I only said that, then she would have said this, and who knows? Oh, it would have been great. We retell the story with variations, but it's the same old story, no matter what we do. And instead, we just drop into the body, and often the body will have a very strong emotional energy, what we'll call raw emotion. And we can tune into that, pay attention to that, because then we can see, oh, this is really unpleasant, probably, number one. the actual physical sensations and the emotional, underlying emotional content is often not pleasant. And then we also have to, and this is the hard part, accept the fact that, yeah, we're actually caught in this unwholesome mind state. I've been caught again. And not beat ourselves up about this. Not to go, oh God, what's wrong with me? I can't, here I am, once again, stuck in an unwholesome mind state. I've been here before. Why didn't I see this earlier? Blah, blah, blah. We can sort of endlessly just beat ourselves up. And instead, just accept it. Yeah, this is what's happening. Be aware of it. Pay attention to it. This is now a wholesome mind state. You're actually in the present moment paying attention to what's arisen. That's all. So you switch that unwholesomeness to something wholesome. And you have to be sort of learn to be okay, to be sort of calm and even joyful. There's Joseph Goldstein tells a great story about this particular idea. And he's talking here, sort of, this is partway through a talk he's giving on a famous sutta that talks about five progressive steps you can use to deal with difficult mind states. And this is the final step. When all else fails, the Buddha suggested forcibly suppressing the unwholesome thought. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery game. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of feeling. Here, it's an attitude that takes no quarter, but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. See how light this is? Like he said, he doesn't, it's like he's doing something, but he's at the same time maintaining his sense of humor. There's that almost a joyfulness here, even as he's dealing with these difficult mental horizons. It's just a different way to approach things, which I think is quite skillful. I love that story. So the third aspect of right effort, it's sort of a partner to the first. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Duh. I mean, this seems kind of obvious, doesn't it? Like, do what we can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Do things that bring about calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. But how often do we do this? Consciously do this. Choose to live in this way. You have to actually like go, oh, I have to consciously put effort into making this happen. I have to cultivate loving kindness. I mean, you can do loving kindness practice. I mean, that's, you know, or compassion practice. There's lots of practices, forgiveness practice. There's lots of ways you can do this. But it's like, I want to actually go out of my way to cultivate wholesome mind states. And in our daily lives, it's sort of like, have these little reminders that, you know, you are stuck at a red light. This is a great Thich Nhat Hanh example. You're stuck at a red light in the car. And you're probably going someplace. So if you're in the car, you're probably because you're going someplace, right? And what do? You sit there, oh, God, that light's red. How come it's so long? And we just get caught in this rant, small mini rant perhaps, but a rant nonetheless about traffic. Boulder's getting so busy. There's so much traffic. There's way more traffic lights than there used to be when I first lived here. You know, whatever, whether it's Boulder or some other place. In my case, Boulder. Instead, what Thich Nhat Hanh says is, oh, look, I have to stop and sit still. What a great opportunity. I'll take 5 breaths. Just make it into a little mini practice time instead. And this is like cultivating a wholesome mind state instead of cultivating an unwholesome one. And this is like, so we used to have these cues, like every time you stop at a red light, it's a good one because it's like we all do that to a certain extent. Every time you turn on your computer or turn on your phone, pause and take a few breaths before you do anything else. Just 3 breaths and then go on dealing with what you have to do with in your life. But take that space, just a few moments. This is cultivating the wholesome mind. It's like, oh, before I look any further at what's on my computer screen, I'm just going to sit here and take 5 breaths. It just shifts the energy of the whole thing. It's cultivating the wholesome mind state. The fourth and final aspect of wholesome effort. This is often, people find this the most difficult one. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. Don't cling to them. That'll just make them go away. But preserve them. There's 2 steps to this. First off, you have to actually see that a wholesome mind state has arisen, which often we don't. They just sort of slip by. But really sort of acknowledge the fact that there is, that you can have wholesome mind states. And here's one right now. Isn't this great? You know, and enjoy it. I mean, this is like a wonderful thing when a wholesome mind state has arisen. This actually takes quite a bit of effort sometimes because we're sort of programmed both culturally and biologically to look for what's wrong. Look for the problems. Look for what isn't working. Look for, you know, the not good stuff. And sometimes it's easier to see the unwholesome stuff, the unpleasant stuff. When we feel a wholesome mind state, when you feel calm or you feel joyful, the first thing we have to do is just accept, oh, this is what's arisen right now. That's the first step in maintaining it, is acknowledging it, accepting it. It's like, often we fall into the pattern of something like, I can't be calm like this. I need to stay on edge to be watchful and worried. Right? Or even, I don't deserve to be this happy. These thoughts are unwholesome mind states. We've just lost the wholesome just by those thoughts. So when you see those thoughts, sort of thoughts arise and go, oh, wait, I don't need to go there. I've just shifted from a pleasant, wholesome mind state, which is good. The more wholesome mind states we have over a long period of time, the better. It makes us, encourages us to practice more. So there's no magic here. You know, to be full of wholesome mind states more often takes effort. It's like, and that's the whole idea behind this idea of right effort, is to, if you see unwholesome, do what you can to not have unwholesome mind states arise. Do what you can to ease or get rid of the unwholesome mind state that has arisen. Do what you can to create the causes and conditions that a wholesome mind state might arise. And then when the wholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to maintain it. It's a great set of thoughts. And then out of that repeated wholesome mind state that keeps coming more and more often, mindfulness and concentration, the final two steps on the Eightfold Path, have a chance of arising. Remember that we can't just sort of be mindful. We can't just be concentrated. Mindfulness and concentration are wholesome mind states that arise when the causes and conditions are such that they can arise. Everything up until now has been doing what we can to create the causes and conditions so that mindfulness can arise and be there, or that concentration can arise and be there. It's not like we can sort of switch them on. Oh, I'm going to sit and close my eyes and now I'm mindful. No, I'm sitting, I'm closing my eyes, and I'm doing what I can to create the causes and conditions so that mindfulness might arise. That's the best I can do. It's all I can do. And then if mindfulness does arise, notice it, pay attention, and do what I can to preserve it, of course, because it's a wholesome mind state. So the mindfulness is usually discussed in the Theravada tradition. It's the practice of what's called Vipassana. There are many, many techniques for practicing Vipassana. I'm not going to spend any time at all talking about the actual various wonderful techniques of practice. And that's a whole other set of talks. And it's really just doing whatever we can to stay in the present moment, to be paying attention to the present moment more and more all the time. I mean, it's really what we're talking about. The English word mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word sati. And like many translations, mindfulness is incomplete, shall we say. It doesn't cover all the various aspects of what that word sati might mean. And there are four other qualities of mindfulness I want to talk about so we get a better understanding of what this means, because we sort of, mindfulness has become one of those words that sort of entered the culture and is now, who knows what it means, you know. There's, I could be mindfully playing football because my mindfulness coach taught me how to do it, you know. Anyhow, so the first of the four that I want to talk about is not forgetting. This is sort of staying firmly with the object, not wandering. That's a good definition about mindfulness. But there's a sense in this particular one, a sense of solidity, of grounded solidity. The image I like to see in my mind, because I work with wood and I actually build fences, is it's like setting a post in the ground, you know, and digging the hole and putting in all of the right kind of cement and setting the post and propping it and letting it, like, it's like really solid and steady. That's what this means by not forgetting. Then there's another word, presence. Do we have presence? Presence of mind. Is that another interesting translation or idea? And this has to do with having presence means not looking away. You know, often we're sitting there and something comes up and it's like, oh, no way, I want to look at that stuff. And we just push it away. You know, we give in to the aversion that thought or story or whatever brings to mind. And that's not mindfulness. That's not what we're talking about. We actually have to be able to sit through that aversive experience, be aware that we're caught in aversion, instead of trying to like keep our distance from things, like, oh no, don't want to go near that, don't want to touch that, don't want to have anything to do with that. We don't want to try and keep our distance. In fact, we want to get close to things, the opposite of keeping our distance. Even the unpleasant, we want to get close to it and see it for what it is. And I'm not talking, this is like, it almost, this has the tendency, if we're not careful, of this sort of becoming like this masochistic, let's wallow in it, you know? No, don't want to do that either. I want to just see it for what it is and be okay with it, to have presence. Another direct translation of the word sati is the word, English word, remembering. I want to read another thing from Joseph Goldstein here. He's talking about different aspects of mindfulness. The third aspect of sati is one that doesn't often, we don't often associate with mindfulness, but in fact, it harkens back to its root meaning of remembering. Here, mindfulness calls to mind or remembers what is skillful and what is not, what is inferior and what is refined, what is beneficial and what is harmful. It is this aspect of mindfulness that makes it possible to follow the Buddha's instructions to let go of and abandon what is unskillful and to develop and cultivate what is skillful. So remembering is directly related to wholesome effort. Mindfulness thus becomes a key factor in strengthening our inner moral compass. If we don't remember and call to mind what is wholesome and what is not, then we simply toss about on the waves of habitual mind states, often acting out of the latent tendencies of different defilements. So actually remembering what's skillful and what isn't, what's harmful and what isn't, what leads me forward and what pulls me down. It's remembering. Then there's one more thing here. And that's mindfulness has this flavor, an association with the idea of wisdom, in simplicity of just, it's plain. Doesn't have to be fancy at all. Doesn't have to be a big deal. It just has, it's a simpleness to it. There's a famous sitting instruction, just sit and know you are sitting. That is all. It's the entire instruction one teacher used to give people. Just sit and actually know that you are sitting. Be aware all the time that that's what you're doing. You know, how often are we sitting and our mind is off, who knows where? Planning, remembering, blah, 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 blah. Just sit and know you're sitting. So that means, it also means not making up stories about what we're experiencing. Yeah, I'm sitting there, my knee starts to ache, and the story starts about, he's going to ache for the rest of the day now. This is going to be so horrible. You know, we're just going. Just making up stories as opposed to just paying attention to what's actually happening right now. One of the long retreats I sat, I had a very interesting experience of this. At the time, I was doing a lot of sitting practice, and I found that I often would wake up in the middle of the night. You know, I'd go to sleep around 10, around 2 or 3 in the morning, I'd wake up. And then I'd go, oh no, I don't want to get up yet. I'd sleep until 5 or 4:30 or 5, actually. But I was talking to my teacher about this in one of my interviews, and he said, oh, if that happens, just get up. Practice. Here you are, you're awake anyway. What a great time to practice. Okay, I thought, well, that's interesting thought. So the next night, I fall asleep like I normally did, exhausted. About 2 in the morning, I wake up, I'm wide awake. And I go, oh, okay, I guess I should go sit. Well, so I get some clothes on, and I'm where I'm sleeping is right next to the Dharma Hall. So I don't have too far to walk. I walk and I get into the Dharma Hall, and I go to my cushion. I'm the only one there. At 2 in the morning, the Dharma Hall is not busy, right? And it's really quiet. I'm going, oh, this is so great. This is so cool. Here I am sitting here, and no one else is here. Usually there's like 90 people in the hall, right? So I'm sitting there, and I start hearing this sort of weird gurgly noise coming from the pipes in the building. And it's like I become totally fixated on this weird gurgling that I don't hear during the day when I'm sitting. I never hear this noise when I'm sitting. And I was like, oh my God, there's this gurgling noise. What's that? I'm going to note it. I'm just going to note this. Everything's going to be okay. I'll just note it. And then I decide, I don't know how I got here, but it was very striking. Just outside the Dharma Hall, there's a statue of the Buddha that's in a pool. So there's the Buddha in the sort of pillar in the middle, and then this big pool all around it. And I decide, as I'm sitting there, just hearing this sound, all I'm doing is hearing the sound and noting it, that the sound I'm hearing is the sound of a body of someone who's drowned in the pool and is blocking the drain. You know, oh my God. And part of me goes, oh God, this is so crazy. You know, I'm laughing at myself. But at the same time, it's like the story gets bigger and bigger. Maybe it's that person who always looks so unhappy. But, you know, it's like the story just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I can't stop myself. I actually, in the end, I got up. Walked out to the out through the foyer, out into the little plaza, and looked in the pool. I mean, I had to go look in the pool. And this one, I said, "Oh, this is crazy." I went back to bed. But it's like that's what we do. Some little noise, this weird sucky sound, turned into a dead body in the pool. And who am I going to tell? And who do I better go wake up the manager? And oh my God, what about this? Just from nothing. There's a Pali word called papancha. This was papancha. Pancha means roughly translated as proliferation. Just a little sound. Just the noise of this weird sucky sound. And I figured out later, this is just like the pool probably goes through some cycle in the middle of the night when no one's around, where it gets all the water sucked out and new water put in to keep it clear. I don't know, something like that. But it was just like, because I never heard that sound again. Never heard the sound again. But it was like this enormous story. Instead of simply just being simple, just pain, just noting, oh, maybe note the sound, note my irritation at the sound. That's fine. That's all I needed to do. But I got caught in this whirling story about it. That, anyhow, I want to read one more thing. This is a description from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a well-known Dharma teacher in the West. And this is his description of mindfulness, which I think is quite wonderful. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it is occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves on the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now without slipping away, without getting swept away by the tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. Undoing our habitual patterns. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. That's a great description, I think. And then finally we come to concentration. And first of all, I want to say that all meditative practices, whether it's contemplative prayer in the Christian tradition, mantra practice, visualization practices, all kinds of different practices, all of them are, to one extent or another, have a strong element of concentration involved. Concentration is like essential to the whole process. And so basically, your concentration has sort of these two forms. You know, there's this concentration that we've been talking about, which is paying attention to what's arising in the moment. So the object of concentration, the object of meditation, what we're paying attention to, keeps changing. Every few seconds, now there's a new object. But we're just concentrating on what's arising, what's most prominent in our field of our senses in any particular moment. That's what we're concentrating on. So this is concentration on a shifting, continuously shifting and changing object. The other form is has to do with concentrating on one single point. So this would be like with a mantra. It could be, like I said, with a visualization. In the Theravada tradition, this has to do with practicing the Brahma Viharas, like metta practice, where you have metta practice where you have four phrases you repeat over and over and over. Now you've got a single point, just these phrases, nothing else. Thank you very much. And if your mind wanders, you just come back to that point. You keep coming back to that point. There are many forms of practice like this. these are both forms of concentration. It's not that one is better than the other. There are also within traditional Vipassana practices ways that you can tend towards concentration more. Counting the breaths, for instance. So, but remember that concentration is simply a wholesome mind state that arises, given that you've created the causes and conditions, or tuned into the causes and conditions, some of which you created, such that it can. It has a very distinct, it's when you're concentrated, typically you know you're concentrated. It has a very distinct flavor, like nothing else I know. And as you go into deeper states of concentration, it becomes much clearer and clearer and clearer. But that's what's going on. But it's essential that you learn to concentrate, that you actually keep going back to that object over and over and over and over. So somehow these last three aspects on the Eightfold Path, we're trying to find this sort of skillful combination and balancing of these three things, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. The three interact with each other, they're very intimately related to each other, and by finding a balance of them all, that makes the practice of meditation fruitful, makes it work. I even hate to use the word work, but it seems like a good word. One last thing I want to say about the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, if you're not careful, you think of a path as going someplace, right? Like it's some sort of straight line. Nope, sorry. It's more like, there's that story about, there's that phrase, yeah. It's more about the journey and not the destination. Very true. It's also really clear to me that if there's a path at all, it's not a straight line, it's a spiral. We keep coming back to aspects of the Eightfold Path over and over and over again. As we deepen our mindfulness and our concentration, we get something, have a few insights, a little clarity, then we go back to right understanding, and it has a whole new meaning that we never saw before. And that new meaning makes us reset and deepen our intention. And then makes us look more deeply at our whole life and how we live in the world. So it's like we're going around in this spiral, deeper and deeper and deeper into what the practice brings us. It's not in any sense of the word. I mean, it's a path in the sense that they take steps and they're connected, but it isn't a straight line with an endpoint. It's a spiral that we keep going a little deeper into the practice and a little deeper understanding. And of course, I have to finish with the poem. This is once again from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And it's called The Song of the Builders. On a summer morning, I sat down on a hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. He was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was his energy! How humble its effort! Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our own inexplicable ways, building the universe. It's a pretty good description of the Eightfold Path, I think. Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our inexplicable ways, building the universe. So that's what I have to say tonight.